Hey, this is DeRay, and welcome to Pod Save the People. Now, today we have Valerie Jarrett, the former senior advisor to the president, and R.T. Ryback, the former mayor of Minneapolis. Excited to talk to both of them. And then, as you know, the news with me, Clint, Brittany, and Sam. We also have Andy Slavitt giving us an update on where we are with healthcare. Before we jump into the podcast today, I've heard people say over and over on panels and speeches, this notion that the system is working as it was designed to. And they say it often in response to a tragedy, in response to deep inequity. And while it is true that the system was designed to be one that disadvantaged a certain set of people over another one, what I also know to be true is that we can change it, that people made the system this way and people can undo it. People can transform it. They can reform it. They can structurally alter it. They're like, we actually have a lot of agency here. So just because it was designed this way doesn't mean that it has to be this way forever. And my advice to you would be to definitely understand the intentional parts of the system, the things that didn't happen by happenstance, but also to remember that we can do this, that we can change it. It won't always be quick. You might not be here when the fruits of your labor actually impact people's lives in a positive way, but that we fight because we know that this is not the way the world has to be. We educate ourselves because we know that we need to be as skilled as possible as we do the work of imagining a new future. Let's go. So this is the news with me, Sam, your favorite data scientist, Brittany, former appointee to the President's Task Force on 21st Century Policing and former educator and member of the Ferguson Commission. And then Clint Smith III, your favorite doctoral student and the resident academic here on Pod Save the People.
Hey, everyone. It's the news. This is Brittany, Miss Pacchetti, on all social media.
What's going on, y'all? This is Clint Smith, Clint Smith III, Clint Smith III on Twitter and Instagram.
This is Sam Sinyangwe at Sam Sway on Twitter.
This is DeRay, DeRay on Twitter. Sam?
Okay, so my piece of news is in Baltimore, the mayor, Catherine Pugh, along with the police chief and other city leaders, proposed a mandatory one-year sentence for illegal gun possession within 100 yards of a school, park, church, public building, or other public place of assembly in the city of Baltimore. And I'm going to just read the quote from Mayor Pugh. She said that there is a church or school on nearly every corner in the city. And as it relates to this legislation, she says that's a good thing. So in other words, particularly in Black neighborhoods in Baltimore, pretty much the entire neighborhood now is going to be under this cloud of a mandatory one-year sentence if you're caught in possession of an illegal firearm. And I bring that to this conversation because oftentimes, you know, on the left, when we talk about guns and gun violence, the immediate sort of reaction and, you know, recommendation or solution that's proposed are these gun control measures that, in some cases, you know, whether it's the assault weapons ban or this proposal from Mayor Pugh, increases criminal penalties on people who are caught in possession of illegal firearms. And disproportionately, those people end up being Black. And so I wanted to have this conversation about how we can address guns without actually leading to accelerating mass incarceration, particularly for Black folks.
And what this makes me think of, Sam, too, is, you know, mandatory minimums came in the era of the war on drugs for so many people in the crime bill. And it makes me think about drug-free school zones that also came in the era of the war on drugs. And what they did is similar to this bill is that they criminalized, they hyper-criminalized things that happened in proximity to school. So in a lot of states around the country, it was if you were 1,000 feet within a school and you sold drugs or whatever, the penalty was increased. And what that had the impact of doing was, A, not decreasing crime, not decreasing drugs, but increasing how many people were criminalized. And in cities like Baltimore, cities across the country, when there are schools literally in every single neighborhood, 1,000 feet is actually a lot of space. So you've just casted a net over low-income neighborhoods in a way that the data is actually proven does not lead to the desired result that people claim that they're putting these things in place for. I think it does help the public feel like something is happening. So like in absence of a plan around safety, right? We know that making sure that people have access to jobs, Yeah, making sure that people have education and resources is actually something that can decrease crime. But in the absence of a plan that gets us there, like things like mandatory minimums, things like drug-free school zones sound like fixes, even if the outcome doesn't lead to them.
And something that this makes me think about is this book, Ghetto Side, by Jill Liovia, I believe is how you pronounce her name. And essentially, the argument of the book, she's a reporter out of L.A., and she talks about the incredibly high homicide rate in Los Angeles. And she's reported on that for many, many years. And what she finds is that what happens is that part of the reason the homicide rates are so high is because while we often have this discourse of policing in Black communities being one of over-policing, in some ways, actually what happens in Black communities is this idea of under-policing. Because so many of these things are going unsolved. And so what happens is that communities and gangs and the people engaged in violence in these communities feel like they have to take measures upon themselves in order to get some sort of retribution or some sort of justice for things that have been done against them, because the police in these communities deprioritize the lives of Black folks in ways that they would never for more affluent white communities, right?
So another piece of news that I think is really important to pay attention to that I didn't know was that 2016 was, in fact, the deadliest year for environmental activists around the world. On average, there were 4 land activists killed in each week of 2016. Like I said, making it the bloodiest year on record. The Guardian, in partnership with an organization called Global Witness, which is a human rights watchdog group, have partnered to be tracking these deaths, and they simply amount to police repression, activist repression, and murder, because people are standing up to defend their culture, standing up to defend natural resources, standing up to defend the survival of their people and of their country, and to ensure that this world can continue to feed its children.
And I think this is really important, because what we know to be true is that you can't disentangle the conversation around environmental justice from the sort of contemporary debates around public policy that we have. And I'm thinking specifically about the current healthcare bill that, you know, at the moment might look like it's dead, but with Mitch McConnell, you're never sure. And as long as the Republicans have both the House and the Senate, we have to continue to be wary. But, you know, we can't have conversations about pre-existing conditions without also talking about the conditions in Black and brown and poor communities that lead to people having certain medical conditions in the first place. And that oftentimes a lot of these, the sort of disparate health outcomes that we see between Black folks and brown folks and poor folks and their white counterparts is based on the environmental conditions in which people live. And so I think it's important that we continue to hold those two things together as we consider the sort of contemporary political debate around our healthcare system.
You know, it reminds me of the fact that, you know, as we're talking about people defending the environment and the people whose lands, you know, these have always been, right, indigenous peoples, and how many things we still, you know, in terms of Western culture, you know, still doesn't understand and still could learn from so many people, from the biodiversity, you know, in the Amazon and so many areas across the world. And that's all getting sort of cleared away and destroyed for, you know, the corporate profits and for powering sort of this engine that is in fact polluting much of the earth. And so, like, how do we continue to defend and stand up for people who are on the front lines protecting the environment, protecting indigenous groups whose lands these are? Because we need to actually, you know, there's so much we can learn in terms of curing diseases, in terms of so many other you know, ways of life and interacting and culture and language. And so, you know, all of that is so essential. And you never know, you know, how, when that is actually going to come into play and be so essential, you know, if something ever happens. So I think, you know, it's incredibly important, the work that they're doing and the sacrifices they're making.
It does also remind me that there are people all across the world working on a set of issues around equity that don't make the mainstream. And I think about, for so many people, it wasn't until the pipeline protests and no DAPL protests here in America that people started to understand Latin activism in the popular media. but this work has been going on across the world for a long time. And Brittany, I didn't know that this was the deadliest year for these activists, because we have been sort of head down focusing on criminal justice issues. But like you said, Sam, all of this stuff is intertwined.
So last week, David Brooks wrote a column for the New York Times called How We Are Ruining America. And I'm not going to summarize the whole thing. You can read it. Just Google how we are ruining America. It'll come up. But essentially, you know, what it brought up in the sort of social media conversation was this discussion on cultural capital. And while I think that in the piece, Brooks is missing a few essential tenets, specifically the role that race plays in shaping cultural capital and who has access or doesn't have access to certain forms of capital. Part of the discourse I found really interesting because it reminded me that we often have a very singular way of defining what constitutes as cultural capital. So for instance, this idea that someone going to a museum or listening to classical music or eating a certain type of food or being able to pronounce certain types of words denotes a level of sophistication and a level of education that gives them access to certain parts of society that then reinforce existing structural pieces of our world that exacerbate social stratification. There's a researcher who was formerly in Stanford. I think she's in Berkeley now, but Prudence Carter wrote a book in 2005 called Keeping It Real. And in it, she talks about this idea of non-dominant cultural capital, right? That for a lot of Black and brown young people, them not being able to demonstrate the sort of fluidity in certain ways of being that might denote for some people what it means to have access to cultural capital doesn't necessarily mean that they don't have cultural capital, right? And so she's arguing essentially that in certain communities and in certain contexts, one needs a certain type of capital to navigate that space that they might not need in another space. So if you grow up in a community that is deeply impoverished, if you grow in a community up in a community that is doesn't have a myriad of different resources or a social welfare infrastructure, there are ways of navigating that space and there are ways of being in the world that are necessary for in order to protect you, in order to survive, literally. That you develop over years and years, that in that context are types of cultural capital, right? What she's saying is that what we need to do is not say, hey, Black and brown kids, you need to stop acting this way and start acting this way or release, you know, let go of these parts of your lives in order to have access to these things that will create upward mobility for you in your life and your career. What we need to do is teach young people how to hold both of those two things at once, right? To recognize, and essentially it's code switching, right? And essentially, how can we teach young people to recognize that in certain contexts, there are certain ways of being that are appropriate for those contexts and in other ways that are appropriate for a different context?
Yeah, I think it is fascinating, Clint, because in many ways, what we see is that cultural capital, particularly in Black communities, ends up being so powerful, right? Not only as a sort of cultural force, but also as an economic force. And then when you look at, you know, where the money goes, oftentimes that money is not going to Black communities, right? So the cultures that, you know, we spread all across the world, oftentimes, you know, don't result in folks who created that culture, you know, really reaping the benefits from it, right? So we have to have these conversations about cultural appropriation, about even, you know, there was an article I read a while back on intellectual property law and how, you know, in many ways the law is structured in a way that makes it harder for people to actually get the money that they deserve for inventing incredible, you know, ways of speaking, incredible ways of interacting, new dances, new pieces of culture that end up being huge, right? Huge money makers that end up circling the world. And so I think that is something that we need to figure out, how to actually change those systems and structures so that people are rewarded for the ways in which they produce culture, even if that culture is not deemed sort of the normative cultural capital that some folks are used to.
This reminds me of the conversation that was happening in content creation spaces when Vine was shut down, right? I mean, in a much kind of more contemporary, simple example of what you're talking about. Here are content creators who are creating things that go viral, right? Like, we didn't even use that word in this way to describe content that became very popular on the internet.
The other thing, too, that it makes me think of is, so much of the work I think that has happened in public over the past 3 years, definitely since the protest started, is how we are uncentering what is dominant, or like sort of dismantling what becomes dominant in whose world. And Clint, you are sort of pushing us, and Brittany and Sam, everybody's been pushing to reimagine what is dominant in a given context. And there are some skills that you need to navigate, like inner city Baltimore, that a different thing you need to navigate, you know, your time at Harvard, or Brittany, your time at WashU, or Sam, your time at Stanford, right? Like, a different set of skills you need. And how do we validate those in a way that, like, help people see that they have skills, and that that the experiences that they bring with them are valid in our resources too?
Yeah, and I think this is really important for educators as well, right? Because I think it can be very easy for folks who are educating young Black and brown youth to imply either, you know, to imply or to say explicitly that the culture and the language and the experiences that they bring into the classroom have no place there, or that they're not worth anything. And I think what we have to do is say, you know, it's important for you to know Shakespeare. It's important for you to learn Thoreau. It's important for you to study transcendentalism and postmodernism, and to be exposed to this sort of broader set of ideas. But that doesn't mean that that Shakespeare is more important than not. That doesn't mean that the opera is more important cultural experience than going to your favorite hip hop concert, or like creating a dance with your friends that goes viral online, right? I think so. It's important to, again, tell young people that they can have both of those things at once, and that certain experiences and certain ways of navigating the world are appropriate, and it simply depends on the context. But we can do that without ignoring or sweeping aside or dismissing the very real and valuable experiences that so many of our young people bring to classrooms and into their homes every day.
Cool. Now, my piece of news is that in Louisiana and Oregon, but we'll just focus on Louisiana because I was just in Louisiana, for second-degree murder, if you're convicted of second-degree murder and you are found guilty, that one of the penalties, the harshest penalty, is life in prison. And to get life in prison, you actually only need 10 of the 12 jurors to agree. You don't need a unanimous jury to sentence you to life in prison in Louisiana. And I did some research, and this is the same in Oregon. And both laws in Oregon and Louisiana came up around the same time. I think in Oregon, though, it's actually in the Constitution, so it's harder to get out. Came up in the context of the KKK. So it was during the period where black people and people who were mixed were starting to sit on juries, and the KKK and white citizens councils didn't want them to have any power with regard to the criminal justice system. So they made it 10 instead of 12. So with the idea that there would never be that many black people or that many mixed people, non-white people on juries. So the white people would always be able to sentence people to life in prison if they wanted to. And I think that is wild and fascinating that it is only two states that have it like that. When I think about things that don't make the public conversation but would have a huge impact on people's lives, this is one of those things.
So this is fascinating in a couple of ways. One is, you know, the legacy of it. You know, as you said, DeRay, you know, these laws came about in a period of time that was really the imposition of Jim Crow. And they're still in place, right? And they still have the type of impact that was intended. So when you look at incarceration rates, particularly for Black people, those rates are through the roof. If you're talking about Oregon, or if you're talking about Louisiana has the highest incarceration rate of any state. And Oregon imprisons Black people at a higher rate than almost any state. And you know, you can trace that directly back to the types of decisions that were made by the people who really helped impose Jim Crow in those states following Reconstruction. It also reminds me of, you know, when we look at state after state, particularly in the South, but, you know, as you can see with Oregon, not only in the South, some of those Jim Crow laws are still in place. And not only in Louisiana, but also like in Florida, for example, you know, the Constitution, the Florida Constitution of 1868, you know, enacted right after abolition of slavery. And, you know, literally that Constitution includes a provision that disenfranchises Black people. It disenfranchises folks with felony convictions permanently, which leads to 1 in 4 Black people today being disenfranchised. So there are these laws that are still in place. They still have an incredibly harsh effect on our lives today. And, you know, these are Jim Crow laws, and they're still in place.
Yeah, I've talked about before how I think the idea of life without parole is completely ludicrous. I mean, I think the idea that we put human beings in cages for the rest of their lives and give them no opportunity to ever get out is completely misaligned with any notion of justice that I believe in. I think that if people stepped, you know, Duray, you were talking about how you went and visited a prison, earlier today or yesterday. The feeling of being inside a prison reinforces the sort of agency that is stripped away from people, and the idea that like there are a certain group of people inside of that space who will never leave that space. And I don't think we really ground the conversation in that often enough. It is putting human beings in a cage, and in the case of life without parole, saying you will never, ever get out.
You know, Bryan Stevenson talks about slavery never having ended, but it merely evolving into the very kinds of things we're talking about right now. And this reminds me, Clint, of what we talked about a couple of weeks ago, about if we have the courage to actually envision a world without prisons, how we would have to value people differently, how we would be forced to rehabilitate people differently, how we would be forced to have different conversations about safety for everything from victims of gun violence to victims of abuse. I think that it's a necessary conversation because the notion that we can simply throw people away is something that we should all be disturbed by. And yet, because we have been so ingrained in the idea that safety is locking people up and throwing away the key, it's a much harder conversation to have. And I will say, especially as a woman, that I do find that conversation challenging. There are certain crimes that I am more willing to contemplate not seeing a great deal of jail time or any jail time at all versus other crimes. When I think of crimes of sexual abuse, domestic abuse, crimes against children, murder, it is much harder to actually discuss that concept. And yet I think that if we don't push ourselves to talk about what a world without jails and a world without walls could really look like, we're not actually going to advance beyond the kind of incremental or minuscule changes we've been making, if we've been making those changes at all, because as has already been shared, a lot of these laws are quite old and still remain on the books.
That's the news. Annie Slavitt, former head of Obamacare for the past 3 years, is here to give us an update on healthcare. Andy, what is going on with healthcare?
Well, DeRay, you always have your podcast on a very busy night, and tonight was the night that the Senate finally came to grips with the fact that it doesn't have the votes to pass to repeal the ACA in its current form.
So what's the new plan?
Well, the new plan is that the Trump team and Senate leadership met. They just came out with a statement which says that they're now going to bring to the floor what's known as a repeal and delay. That is a full repeal of the ACA, every single element of it, and that wouldn't take effect for 2 years. That's what they're now going to bring to the floor.
And what would be the consequence of a full repeal? So we've been talking so much about Trump Care, which is not a full repeal, correct?
Correct.
What's a full repeal look like?
A full repeal basically says that everything that's in the ACA, all of the coverage gains that were made in the ACA, would go away. Now, they would have it on a ticking time bomb so that it wouldn't take effect for 2 years. And the idea would be to pressure the Democrats into sometime in those 2 years voting for a replacement plan and having that replace the ACA. Now, that's not realistic, and that would never happen. But nonetheless, it would accomplish a couple things for the Republicans. It would honor their promise that they believe they made to their base that they'd repeal the ACA. It would it would get the enormous tax cut passed, and it would attempt to shift the pressure to the Democratic Party.
And when would this vote happen, if it happens at all?
Well, we don't know yet. It could happen this week. It could happen next week. But I think what is also really important is that the people who have been doing such a good job getting us to the point where we've gotten to right now make it really plain and clear that this is just unacceptable. And I would believe that many Republicans know that this is unacceptable. Many Republicans have gone on record as saying this is unacceptable. But I think it's critical that people not take today as a victory. Take it as progress, but not as complete victory. It's time to finish the job by making sure Congress knows that this is not acceptable.
And isn't it true that some of the Republicans who wouldn't support Trump Care weren't supporting it because it wasn't actually harsh enough, that it wasn't repealing enough?
That's exactly right, Dre. In fact, the two votes that came tonight to say the no votes against Trump Care actually came from senators that were more conservative, that felt that Trump Care wasn't doing enough to end coverage and reduce cost.
That is so wild. So what should we be looking forward to this week and early next week?
I think right now, the most important thing is that there is no let up. We're so close to sending the message that you can't just willy-nilly take away health care for millions of Americans. But remember, right now, as we're talking, there are men sitting around the White House, and I do mean men, who have as their goal still to end Medicaid and to take health care away from millions of people. And they have a lot of tools. In fact, even if they don't succeed in Congress, there's a lot of things that they can do just using administrative powers of the office, executive privileges that can take away care from people. So the next few days are going to be incredibly important to, I think, in my mind, put a final defeat on the legislative process. And if we do that successfully, the good news is that it's quite possible that we could have Democrats and Republicans finally sitting down together, working on putting something together. In fact, John McCain actually issued a statement saying now's the time for Democrats and Republicans to sit down together. And so out of this, that's the kind of thing we ought to be encouraging.
And what do you think would come from Democrats and Republicans sitting down together?
Look, if you do this thing the right way, what you do is you have hearings, you have experts, you look at the real issues, you look at things like prescription drug costs, which drive the cost of healthcare very high. You look at all the people that aren't getting care that should, and you find new ways to do it. And you spend more time, you spend a year, maybe even a little more than a year, but you forge some sort of compromises on how to make improvements. And, you know, that's the way we've historically done things up until this administration. That's the way we tend to make better laws. That's the way that people in the country tend to get involved. And while we never get it perfectly, we can make progress. And for the millions of people out there who, over the course of the last few weeks and months, have said, hey, wait a minute, why don't we have universal coverage? Why don't we have some access to healthcare for everybody? I think this could end up being a real turning point, but it won't be a turning point until we finally finish and defeat this Trump Care beast once and for all.
Well, thanks, Andy. And, you know, the news just broke Monday night. So thanks for keeping us posted.
I'm glad you could be the first to report it.
Don't go anywhere. More Pod Save the People's coming. And here is my conversation with Valerie Jarrett, the most trusted advisor to President Obama during both of his terms in office. Valerie, it is great to have you on Pod Save the People.
Thank you, D-Ray. I've been looking forward to our conversation.
I love it. I'm interested in a lot of things. Want to start with what does it feel like to be out of the White House right now? That you were there from day one the end. How many people were actually there the whole time?
That's a good question. I don't know how many of us. There were a fair number, but I'm the only one that served in that senior advisor capacity for all 8 years. And I knew going in that if the president would have me, I would want to stay for the duration. I can't imagine having missed 1 minute of that unique opportunity. And so I guess I'm going through the natural stages of transition, first sleeping a lot and then just reflecting on so much that changed around the country and the world during those 8 years, and then the work ahead. And I'm spending a lot of time, as you know, focusing on issues that I care a lot about, like criminal justice and gender equity and civic engagement. And so in a sense, that helps because I feel that you don't have to be in the White House to do the people's work.
So you had never been in the White House before? You'd never been in a role in the White House before?
Oh, goodness, no. I'd only been to the White House, I think, 2 times. I had a cousin, Anne Marchand, who worked for President Clinton.
Okay.
And she took me there once for a behind-the-scenes tour, and then I went to her goodbye party, and that's it. Those are the only times I'd ever been to... No, actually, one other time under President Clinton I visited for a party. That was pretty exciting.
What did you... I have to imagine that you learned so much in those 8 years, that you grew so much in those 8 years. What are some things that you learned that you just didn't know before, either about the way systems work, about issues that you were like, wow, I didn't know this was, I had no clue the scale of this issue was this issue, or the power of the presidency?
Well, that's a big question. So lots in terms of the nuts and bolts. I had spent a lot of time working with the federal government from my positions at state and local government in Chicago. And so I'd seen it in a sense as the recipient of federal funds and had a lot of problems with how the federal government was organized. But I didn't just probably appreciate just how complicated the bureaucracy is until joining the administration. I think I thought that the president of the United States would have the ability to really drive Congress in a way that, as you know, the Republicans in Congress made up their mind very early on that they weren't going to work with us. And I was remarkably disappointed with how hard it was to motivate them to try to put their short-term political interests to the side and really focus on what was best for the country, particularly if you think, DeRay, of everything that was happening in our country when President Obama took office. The banks were on the verge of the collapse. We were losing 750,000, 800,000 jobs a month. Millions of people were losing their homes. People were seeing their retirement savings evaporate overnight. And so when we heard that Senator McConnell said, like, his number one issue was to make sure that President Obama didn't get reelected, I thought, well, really? Of all the things that we have on our plate, both domestically and on the foreign policy stage, how could that possibly be? And it took me a while to really appreciate that short-termism that you see here in Washington all too often.
And to so many of us, you are like the, we saw you as like the friend in chief, the advisor in chief in the White House, the confidant. What was your day? What did that look like?
What exactly was it that I did with my day, huh?
Yeah.
Well, we started the day with senior staff meetings with Dennis McDonough, the chief of staff, and his predecessors, a small group of senior team. And then we would have a bigger meeting with the senior team and really talk about what was happening in the course of the day, what our events for the day would be, what the president was trying to accomplish for that week, as well as some long-range planning. And then I would meet with my teams and really say, these are the marching orders. These are the hot button issues that we have to attend to. And then what I loved about my day is that it was such a broad range of people who I had a chance to meet with and a whole host of policy topics. And so no one day was like another day.
And how did your relationship with President Obama change over time? I have to imagine that both of you being new to such different roles, him as President of the United States, you as senior advisor, you there from the beginning, him obviously there from the beginning, that you both had to face a set of issues that were new, a set of challenges that were new, a set of people and experiences. So how did that relationship change over time or grow or get tested?
It's a good question. So first of all, I met the President and First Lady 26 years ago. So we go back to 1991. In fact, July of 1991, I met them when I was trying to recruit then Michelle Robinson to come and join me in the mayor's office in Chicago. And she was so impressive. And I looked at her as she was such an old soul. She asked such smart questions in the interview. And I made her a job offer basically on the spot. And so wisely, she said she wanted to think about it. And then she and I were talking a few days later, and she said, my fiance doesn't think this is such a good idea. So I'm like, well, who's your fiance? And so she said, well, his name is Barack Obama. He started his career as a community organizer. And he may disagree with Mayor Daley. And then where does that put us? And so he was wondering if you'd have dinner with us. So the three of us had dinner. And I raise that because I think the longevity of our relationship, as it is in all relationships, means that by the time we got here, it had been tested. It had endured the length of time. I remember when they married, and my daughter was, I think, like 6 when they met, and she's 31 now. And I remember when their children were born, and all of our different career paths that we've taken, his various campaigns for office. And so we knew each other really well, and we trusted each other. We respected each other. We loved one another. And I think that that's the solidification of that relationship happened before we came here. And so that made this change a lot easier. I will say I teased him when he offered me the job, because I said, well, I've been the older one and the mentor. Now you're saying I have to work for you? And he said, well, I am going to be the president of the United States. So how bad could that be? But I share this with you. And your audience, it feels like it's just you and I chatting, but out your audience as well. You never know how someone's going to be in a position until they're in it, particularly something new. And I had complete confidence that he had the integrity and the rigor and the intellect and the compassion and empathy to be a really great president. But it wasn't until we were actually in the White House and I saw him in action that I really began to have this full appreciation for his ability to stay singularly focused on you, the American people, and to take that long view and to be able to go through an enormous amount of scrutiny and criticism and challenge to get to that kind of true north. And he just never disappointed me. Didn't mean we always agreed on every single issue. You shouldn't. And he encouraged people to push back and come up with new ideas. And part of what he created as a manager was a safe space where everybody on the team could express themselves. But I always knew he never lost that focus. And I was really impressed with his groundedness and his ability to take all that incoming. And part of being a leader is you got to take a lot of pain and recognize that your pain pales in comparison to the people you're trying to help.
If you had 4 more years or 2 more years or 3 more years, what would you have liked to do?
Yeah. Well, we ask ourselves that a lot. And I will say one of President Obama's strategies, which was a good one, is at the beginning of each term, he really did map out, this is what I want to get done. Really, every 2 years, he would write on a piece of paper, these are the priorities, and let's put them in order, and let's keep focused on that. You've got to respond to a lot of incoming, but let's not lose sight of what we want to try to get done. And so at the end, you look back quite naturally, and you say, what was the work unfinished? I think the two biggest pieces of business for me personally were criminal justice reform, because we had so much bipartisan support. I think when we left, we had counted about 80 votes in the Senate to reduce mandatory minimum sentences for nonviolent drug offenders. And everybody across the political spectrum understood that our current system is inhumane, and that you could be smart on crime, but not lose sight of the goal, which is to keep as many people out of the system as possible, make sure that they have a good education and a job and opportunities. And if they do get caught up and they earn a second chance, give them the tools to have a successful second chance and make sure they have whatever it is that they need, and then give them a job. Reunite them with their family. Let them become members of society. And it just seems so obvious, and I was so frustrated that, again, politics got in the way. And the vast majority of people who are incarcerated are not at the federal level, so the federal legislation was just to be a template for the country. And I'm heartened to see a lot of activity around the country. I was just up in Connecticut with Governor Malloy, who had a conference on criminal justice, and he's already putting in place bail reforms and is raising the age for minors to be tried. doing a lot of really good reform work there. And so I'm spending a lot of time at the state and local level on that. The other area where I just am very frustrated we were unable to get legislation through is just keeping guns out of the wrong hands. And, you know, I'm from Chicago, and you see what's happening in Chicago. And there's a whole range of reasons why the violence is what it is. But it doesn't help to have a state next door like Indiana that has such lenient gun laws. And people just drive across, you know, it's 15 minutes from Indiana into the middle of Chicago and open up a truck and just pass out guns. How can that happen in our country? We know where these gun shops are. So why can't we do something about that? So that was disappointing. The other final initiative I'll mention is immigration reform. There was bipartisan support. And I remember when Cantor lost, like everything went down the drain. How could one person's loss change the whole psyche of Congress? And it would have been good for the economy. It would have been stabilizing for so many families who live in great fear. It would have been the right thing to do. And it would have made our country stronger. We've always been a nation of immigrants. So those are
Cantor's loss that really tanked that.
It really did. It really did. I think it spooked the House. And before that, Speaker Boehner had said we would move forward after those initial primaries were over. And I think when he lost, the kind of the will went away. And then, you know, in this time, you're always in an election cycle. And so finding that sweet spot when they have the courage to actually do something important and right is fleeting. And those were three where I really thought we should have been able to get them done and behind us on the legislative branch. And then, you know, continuing to improve our education system, making sure that everybody has that opportunity to grow up in a safe environment and not be at risk for any reason. Every young child having a chance to have that dream. I mean, those are the goals you come in with, and you know you'll never perfect our union in 8 years, but we'll just have to continue that work, as I said, from the outside.
When are you running for office?
I'm going to be supporting you in your next run for office. It's so funny you would ask me that question. I so enjoy seeing young people with that bug and that spirit. I don't know if you know Michael Tubbs, who's the mayor of Stockton.
Mm-hmm.
So I met him when he was still at Stanford.
Oh, wow.
In the president's first term. And he came up to me and he said he was thinking about wanting to intern and up on the Hill. And I said, well, why wouldn't you intern in the White House? And so he applied and he received an internship at the White House.
Wow.
And he always said to me, I'm going to run for office one day. And the fact that he's actually the mayor of Stockton
awesome.
Just makes me so happy. So I'm really interested in finding those young,
so you're not running.
Extraordinary people. I don't think so. I have spent about half my career in public service and half in the private sector. I often say that my worst days in the public sector, and I've had some bad ones, were still better than my best days in the private. And so public service is in my spirit, and I want to continue to help. I'm working, for example, with President Obama's Obama Center and this platform for engagement I described to you at the beginning. So that's really where I think my heart is right now.
I remember meeting you for the first time in a small room in the it wasn't the White House. It was in the Eisenhower.
EEOB.
The EEOB.
Yes, the old executive office building.
Yes.
Named after Eisenhower.
That building. And we were pushing you on what the White House is doing on policing.
Yes.
And I say that because, and you were also in obviously every meeting we have with the president, and we talked to your team often about the protests around the country. And there were so many people. And I remember the last meeting we had with the president. I just got out of jail in Baton Rouge around the same time. And I was very frustrated. And the governor of Louisiana was in the room. And I remember it was like, and there were so many of us who felt like the administration was acknowledging the issue, which was really important, but wasn't moving as quickly or enough or as aggressively. And as somebody who works in systems, I understand the systems are like hard to move quickly because they are systems. But what do you say to the people who feel like we had this incredible moment of a black president? We had a black woman like you as senior advisor. We had a attorney general, two attorney generals who had lived experiences that were deeply indicative of the American condition. And still, things didn't move as quickly as people wanted them to move. What do you say to those
people? As quickly as any of us would want them to move. And I think part of the tough pill that you have to swallow is recognizing that change takes time. And a lot of the change that we were trying to put in place required cooperation at the local level. I mean, you know how many police forces are all around the country. We couldn't make 18,000. We couldn't make them change. And there were limitations. I mean, one of the things we explored, for example, is could we use the purse string to incentivize good behavior and punish bad behavior? Well, a lot of the purses were tied up to legislation, and so the Justice Department didn't have the flexibility that we would have liked them to have had to say, okay, well, if you're going to receive federal funding, then you need to agree that you're going to put in place the recommendations that are in our task force report, because we know they were evidence-based, they were well thought out, you know how broad the advisory board was that worked on them. We know they work. I mean, part of what frustrated us was, and you for sure, was knowing what the solutions are, and then trying to get the wheels to turn to move in that right direction and ensuring that at the local level, there was the political will to do what needed to be done. And so we, you know, you're pushing up against, or we would often say, it's like a battleship and you're trying to turn that battleship. And in 8 years, you can't turn it as far as you want it to go. So you're disappointed, my friend. Oh, my gosh, am I disappointed that we couldn't have gotten more done. But I do think we turned over a really good template on this issue, and that there are initiatives going on now. It's like, for example, the Arnold Foundation is spending a lot of time looking at the important work our chief data scientist team did to look at, you know, what is the correlation between people with mental health challenges and the time they spend in the county jails and the time they spend in the public hospitals. And are we sending people to jail who really shouldn't be in jail? They should be in a treatment or a diversion program, helping develop the tools so that state and local elected officials are making wise public policy decisions. I mean, one of the statistics that we discovered, which probably won't surprise you, is that of the 11 million people who cycle through our jails on an annual basis, they stay an average of 23 days. Mm. Yet only 5% are ultimately convicted and sentenced to prison. Wow. So you have to ask yourself, how wise is it to house somebody for 23 days? What does it cost you? What does it cost them? They lose their job, they're a single mom, they lose custody of their kids. I mean, what are the familial consequences, the societal consequences of those 23 days? When if only 5 are going to ultimately get convicted and sentenced on, we need bail reform. And so I think a lot of that important work is going to continue to happen around the country. And so did we accomplish everything we wanted to do? Absolutely not. But did we provide some very meaningful templates and evidence-based examples of what does work? Sure. I mean, my brother's keeper came out of a tragedy. That came after Trayvon Martin and then the George Zimmerman verdict. And President Obama said we should all do some soul searching and figure out why can't a young black boy walk down the street and be safe, you know, ask ourselves some questions. You can't change that outcome with a law or a program or a regulation. It's a culture change. And that takes more time than I wish it took, but it happens.
Did you see the videos that went viral of the police killing people like Laquan McDonald?
Of course I did. Chicago, I watched Laquan McDonald. I'll tell you. It took me, I want to say, at least over a day before I could watch it, after it was public. And I knew I had to. I felt a responsibility to watch it, but I knew what it would do to me. And then I saw it over and over and over again. And I will tell you, every time I've seen it, I feel like it was the first time. So sure, I've watched all of those.
Did you share those with the president?
Oh, he saw them. Of course he saw them. Yeah, we all watched them. I mean, you can't not watch something like that. And I think that a lot of conversations about this internally and externally, I think there were a lot of people who were so stunned. And then there were a lot of people who were horrified, but not stunned, right? My guess is you were horrified, but not stunned. Yeah. And I think a lot of people had been lulled into this false sense of post-racialism. But we talk a lot about, you know, the talk that every black family has with their sons. I can't tell you how many people have come up to me who weren't Black who said, I didn't know about the talk. And I said, well, because we don't talk about the talk outside of the Black community, because it's embarrassing. Why should we have to tell our boys that they have to behave differently, right, than anyone else? But we do. And the fact that that's now out and we're talking about it more openly, I think is a good thing.
What did it mean for you, either in hindsight now or in the moment, to be a Black woman and to be in this incredibly influential role, to know that there's some kids who don't know a world without a Black president, don't know a world without a Valerie Jarrett as the senior advisor to the president? How do you process what I would think is both the responsibility of that, the weight of that, the sort of honor of that, maybe the fear of that?
All of the above. Whenever you're a first, there's
an
added—
Were you the first Black woman senior advisor?
Yes. Now, I will say Condi Rice was national security advisor, which obviously a very senior position, but first senior advisor, yes. And same, obviously, first Black president. So you feel a certain level of responsibility that you don't want to mess it up because you don't want to make it harder on the second or the third or the fourth. But it's also just an honor and something that you know you're going to, if you have that gold ring, you want to make the best of every single day. And I woke up every day terrified, knowing I'm old enough to know that 8 years is short and it could have been four. And so making sure that every single day we did something to be a force for good and trying really hard to be a role model to not just little Black girls out there, but for everybody, so that they would get used to seeing people who look like us in these positions of great responsibility. Somebody shared with me that their 4-year-old drew a picture of Secretary Clinton. This is in the campaign, and colored her brown. And the mom said, well, why did you color her brown? And the little girl said, we have to be brown to be president.
It's great.
Isn't that a great story? And I just thought this generation that grew up just is going to think this is perfectly normal.
You all are not in office anymore, and people are frustrated and nervous and afraid and about so many, losing so many things, right? Like healthcare, the Muslim ban, right? There are all these things.
Criminal justice.
You all ran on a campaign based on hope and this idea that we have not yet seen the best days of the country. There is so much fear in these moments. What do you tell people who look at you or who call you or who tweet you and say, like, what can I do? Why should I keep fighting?
Well, because I say change was never easy in our country. Go ask John Lewis what it was like walking across that Edmund Pettus Bridge. I mean, change has always been brutal. And the reason why is that the people who are invested in the status quo do not want to let go. They have financial reasons or they have social reasons or cultural reasons for why they don't want to see change happen. And the only way it happens is when the American people get engaged and push. And people have to recognize, and it's harder, I can say this to you since I'm so much older than you, but your generation is used to things happening very fast because that's the way it's been. The technology revolution has transformed our society in 10 years. And so you think that's how things go. Things always take a long time. And what you have to hope is on your watch, and I mean your watch as a citizen, not just while you're in the White House, is that you do the best you can to move the baton down the road and then you hand that baton off to the next generation. And so I tell people that my optimism is still very strong. When I travel around the country and I talk to Americans of all walks of life, there are so many people who are doing extraordinary things, ordinary people doing extraordinary things. And that gives me hope. And the question is just how can we motivate them and help them understand how to have a bigger impact? And again, that's the toolbox that we want to create. And so I say this is no time to grow weary. This is no time to let your fear or your frustration or your anger deflate you. It should motivate you. But people, I want to really be so firm with you on this. People cannot be faint at heart. Change is always hard. And you have to get up every day and you have to just don't let them win by wearing us down. We cannot do that.
Do you think that we'll ever get reparations or something akin to a systemic correction to intentional systemic wrongdoing targeted to marginalized people?
I am pessimistic about that. Look, we couldn't get Congress to just appropriate enough money so every child could have a quality early childhood education. We spend all this money on our prisons, and we can't make sure that children, all children, get off to the right start, where we know that every dollar we spend on early childhood education saves us $7 down the line. I mean, there's a direct evidence-based correlation between that investment. So I tend to think that if we could fix the school system, I'm confident we can compete. I'm confident that we could be entrepreneurial, and I also think a factor that we don't talk enough about, but that I do try to emphasize, is in this global marketplace, diversity is a strength. And more you are finding companies recognizing that the ones who are most successful are the ones who have a senior team, a senior board that's diverse, senior management team that's diverse, because they're trying to compete for business all over the world. And if you're just talking to a homogeneous group of people who think just like you, you're not going to make the most prudent business decisions. What do you think? Let me push it back on you. Do you think that's realistic?
I think it is the trauma that was intentional with regard to race is just so clear, right? As you know, and I know, right? So redlining to Tuskegee to enslavement, like, it's not, this isn't something we have to like dig really deep to be like, wow, this happened and it was a part of a plan.
The harm was done.
Intentionally.
Right? Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. But to get people to think that they have a responsibility to remedy that today. I remember one particular troll I'll never forget. He said to me on Twitter, "You didn't pick any cotton and I didn't own any slaves. Get over it."
Yeah.
That's horrendous.
That is wild.
But there are people out there who feel that way. And so the question is, in light of that, what are the levers we have to level the existing playing field? And what it means is that there are going to be some adults out there who don't get their fair share or their fair opportunity.
And I think about reparations, I think the word is a lightning rod for people, but at the core, it's this idea of acknowledgement and repair. And I think that I still believe that we can figure out acknowledgement and repair at scale. Maybe the federal level is a real challenge, but the local and state level?
Well, and I think, you know, there are certainly enough local elected officials who recognize the inequities of our system. And that's what we're really talking about here, is inequity. And some of it is historic inequity. Some of it is present-day inequity. But this sense that someone is going to write a check to pay for it, and that check alone will remedy it. It won't. I mean, let's face it. If everybody were to receive a big chunk of cash, but they still couldn't get a good education, we'd be in the same problem.
Yeah, and I think that people even think about reparations now more expansive, which you talk about with education, that like when we think about literacy, what would it look like to give every kid born in poverty a set of library books from birth to senior year?
If that's
high school,
reparations,
right?
Yes.
This idea of like correction at scale, that we target the people who are harmed, and then we figure out how to correct it. That is beyond the economic, because you know, a check is not wealth, right? That the racial wealth gap is huge, and that at best might be an income. But there's some places that have done like baby bonds for kids as a way to like build this wealth, right? And that is its own type of reparation. So I'm interested in that. Do you think you ever teach? I could see you being a teacher.
I could easily teach. Yeah, I love spending time
I'm
with
sure
young
you've been
people.
Offered a teaching job. Are you just laying low
been.
Until you?
You know what? I'm taking my time. I announced today I'm going to write a book.
Okay.
Yeah. And
do you have a title?
No, not yet. Not yet. I have a in my head working title, but I haven't said yet publicly what it would be. But part of what I want to do with my book is to teach. And I'm 60, which is hard to believe. And I've learned a lot in the course about leadership and the long view and true north and how to endure the vicissitudes of life and not give up and feel this resilience that I told you that I think is so important for young people particularly to have. So I think my hope is my book will be a teaching instrument, but I could also see affiliating with a university and teaching. I'm just not ready to, like, I'm too busy, like, doing all the things that I really enjoy to say this is the one thing I want to do.
Do you work for the foundation?
No, I'm an unpaid advisor.
Oh.
So.
Do you still talk to the president?
I office with him. So, yeah, we're in the same building. So, yeah, I was just with him yesterday. We were in Chicago talking about the Obama Foundation.
Is there a piece of advice that you've gotten that has stuck with you, either in your career, in the 8 years of the White House, from the president? Is there something that, like, sticks with you that was
Yeah,
advice?
Yeah. Never, well, it's kind of a two-part thing. One is color well within the lines. I got that from my father.
Color well within
the lines. Color well within the lines.
What does that mean?
Be honest. Be ethical. Have integrity. Particularly when it's hard. When temptation is right there. Somebody early on gave me a piece of advice. Phil Schillero, he said, while you're in government, if somebody offers you something and it sounds like it would be fun, you can't do it. Just know you can't do it. And it's public service. And public service is about sacrifice. And it's about making sure that there are no conflicts and the people never question what motivates you. Mm. And so coloring well within the lines is in that.
You all had so many critics. Vocal critics, less vocal critics, people jumped the fence. Like, there were a lot of people who were pushing.
Yeah.
And so many things are written about you, written about President Obama. How did you deal with that? Like, did you read it all? Did you respond to people? I know that you all did some off the record things where you brought people in. Like, how did—
Look, two things. One, we had to earn people's trust. And we as I said early on, I learned that takes time and that takes effort. It doesn't happen overnight. And there are a lot of people who started out protesting or being critical of us who, in the end, we worked really closely with. And that's very satisfying to me to have known that we earned their trust. There are some people who, no matter what we did, were going to be critical. And you have to learn to tell the difference. You've got to learn to be able to tune out the noise and be grounded. You have to know who you are. I mean, I was raised by two parents who instilled very clear values in me and raised me to work hard and be confident and listen and exercise the kinds of kind of moral compass that they thought was right. And if you know that and you have your feet planted firmly on the ground, that makes you more resilient. I always had a safety net of people who I knew me and loved me and cared about me and nurtured me and who I could call. And they weren't interested in whether I worked in the White House. They wanted to hear about what was going on in the rest of my life. And so you have to, I mean, this is kind of one of those life lessons, is that you have to learn to nurture yourself and to not— You can't buckle. You cannot. There's no better revenge than success.
Cool. Well, thank you for coming to Pod Save the People.
I've been so looking forward to this. It was as much fun as I hoped it would be.
Consider you a friend of the pod, and hopefully we'll see you again soon.
I hope you have me back.
Hey, you're listening to Pod Save the People. Don't go anywhere. There's more to come. And now my conversation with R.T. Ryback, the former mayor of Minneapolis. R.T. Ryback, America's mayor. Thank you for being on Pod Save the People.
America's washed-up mayor, but I'm proud to take the term.
How long were you mayor of Minneapolis?
12 years. Okay. In mayor terms, you measure it in dog years, so it was a lot longer than that. But it was wonderful.
And you were not term limited. You chose not to run again.
Right. And I was, as I was approaching sort of the end of it, I was the 12th year, I was really, really focused on the biggest issue, I thought, in my community, which is equity, and the biggest piece of that was education equity. And so I was going to run for a fourth term and be all about close the achievement gap. But I realized that when you're a mayor, bridges collapse, tornadoes hit, cops do things that create controversy, all this kind of stuff. So you never get to control your agenda. So instead, I went off to run something called Generation Next. It was a collaborative table. There are many around the country now that are focused on getting all the players united on creating more opportunity for kids of color in school. So I did that for a couple of years, and I'm still involved with that very much. But now I'm running the community foundation.
Now, I remember when I lived here in Minneapolis and I worked at the school system, one of the things that shocked me was how intense the achievement gap was between white students and students of color here, and that there are over 100 languages spoken in the schools in Minneapolis. What do you make of why the disparities are just so great in a city that is ostensibly really wealthy, right? It's not a city that is generally in poverty.
Almost every single thing is going right with Minneapolis, except the number one thing, which is the fact that there's a huge gap between haves and have-nots, and it breaks along racial lines. So I guess if there's good news is we know what our problem is. The bad news is it's not simple. There's not a single thing to unpack it. But the reason I wanted to just dive into that is that I couldn't, after 12 years, give you a clean, clear answer. There's racism, there's geographic segregation, there's historic trauma, there's all sorts of issues at the root of it, but there's not one ingredient for racial gaps any more than there's one ingredient to bake a cake, and there's no one ingredient to get you out of it. So what we did with schools is really get superintendents and foundations and families and everything together and kind of really peel back the onion. So we dive into early childhood and look at what is the best spot we can intervene in literacy and math and all of that. And so created this battle plan, if you will, public-private plan. And we're making some progress. It's never fast enough for me.
Have you seen the needle move?
There are some that you do see moving. Graduation rates are starting to go up, and that's really, really great. There are places, though, that I think are deeper in impact than the interventions we've had in graduation. We have something called the Northside Achievement Zone. It's probably the most successful model off the Harlem Children's Zone outside of that, and it's doing really remarkable work on early childhood. That's one of many different things that are happening. You will not see that, quote-unquote, pay off for a while. The data is good, showing good results, but the problem people have is that they often want to look for this one big thing. So some people say, let's jump in on early childhood and make sure every kid is ready for school. Yeah. And then let's jump in on kids who are falling out of the system and are slipping into criminal justice system. Yes, but you have to walk and chew gum. And because there's no one single thing. And so that's, I think, what I've tried to do both my work at Generation Next now, and I'm running the Minneapolis Foundation, is to give people the sense of how we can go deeper. But I think a final point is that is the gap. But also, this community, more than almost any in the country, has lived the values of the Statue of Liberty. We're imperfect, but this has been a center for humanitarian relief. It's been a place that has welcomed the largest Somali population outside of Mogadishu, and now the Karen population, and Tibetans, and Liberians.
The Hmong population?
Absolutely, the Hmong population. And what that's meant is that we have more potential global fluency than almost any community in America. And that's true for immigrants, but it's also true for an African-American kid growing up in North Minneapolis who leaves his neighborhood to go to a school in a predominantly white neighborhood and then downtown to their summer job. Their cultural fluency is deeper than mine as a white guy. And so we're really selling this idea that we're building a culturally fluent community that's not just about, quote unquote, opening doors, but about saying somebody like me, who's a 61-year-old white man, won't be a dinosaur because I am connected more with communities that are different than me, which is too rare for people my age.
Somebody recognized you walking by. It was very cute. Oh, okay. she did a double take.
Yeah. It's kind of like being the mascot in town, twins, bear, and washed up mayor.
There was recently a measles outbreak in Minneapolis, one of the largest in the history of Minnesota, and notable because we had all but eradicated measles in America in the early 2000s. Why do you think, what do you make of that?
Well, one of the issues on that is that there were some rumors that went through the Somali community where there was extraordinarily high autism, that immunization was tied to that. That's false. And yet for some people, if you can imagine going to another country in a strange culture, and the people from most like you said something to that, you wouldn't necessarily doubt them. And so one of the things we've had to do is to make sure that public health officials and trusted community members and all are putting out this idea. This is this idea that the immunization causes autism.
Now, shifting a little bit to talk about national issues, it is, I've heard that you are close friends with President Obama.
I wouldn't call it close friends. He's been super nice to me. I was the first mayor in the country to endorse him.
Really?
I was very involved in the draft Obama movement. And when sort of way back, he'd given his speech in at the convention in Boston. So obviously he was on the radar, but it was during the time when I, you know, when you'd read the bios that he was sort of wrestling with Michelle about whether they should do this or not. And I just had a chance to, you know, do a quick meeting with him. And I just said, it's not often that a single person with a single act can change the world, but you can. And he kind of laughed and he said, well, that's really heavy. But from that time, I worked with him and I never asked for anything. I never wanted to go to Washington. I never wanted a job. I just wanted the president I've wanted all my life and I got it. And one of the cool things about him is he never really forgot. And that's, you know, that's a very cool part of him.
Did you get to talk to him before he left office?
I did. He was kind enough to invite me in for just to say a quick goodbye on the Friday before he left. And it was a really tough moment, frankly, because, you know, I'm walking down in front of the White House and here's this reviewing stand where I just remember the Obama sitting and now it's being set up for Donald Trump, who, you know, I have no respect for. And it was really hard. And so I walked into his office and I gave him a letter my wife had written about that night in Des Moines and what it felt like when he won the caucuses and they announced and now the next first family of the United States of America. And I was overwhelmed at the time. But when I told him then, right as he's leaving office, I just lost it because I just felt so hopeless, you know, having gone by this reviewing stand for Trump and all this. And he just like grabbed me on the shoulder and said, real intently, we are not done. And he just walked, he said, I'm going to take a vacation. Then we're right back at it. And it was so powerful and really kind of lifted me. And last night I saw the Kennedy Profiles in Courage Awards where he gave a speech. And, you know, no, he is not done and he is focused on that. But the fact of the matter is, it was never about Barack Obama. And it was always about a much broader movement. That's the way he saw it. That's where he and I connected. And it shouldn't be about Barack Obama now. He is a piece of the ecosystem, but we all created Barack Obama, the successful president. And we all have to create that in a broader way because we shouldn't look for heroes. We should look in the mirror.
I like that. You know, I remember when I met him the first time in the Roosevelt Room, for our first meeting, and he was as gracious as people thought he was, but also more inquisitive and pushed in a way that I didn't think came across like in the media as well. I got arrested in Baton Rouge, and right after that, there was a meeting with President Obama, unconnected things, but in my head, I will never forget being in jail for the 17 hours and then having to go to the White House. And he was, you know, the advocates we were pressing for the DOJ to use the funding power to hold police departments accountable.
Right.
And he was pressing everybody to understand that more in a way that was really impressive. And like people just didn't get to see that much. When you think about Trump, and there is a healthcare plan that would do real damage, there's a burgeoning tax plan that could also do a lot of damage. What is your assessment of either how we got here or like what the work ahead looks like?
People vote for something. And there's a lot wrong with Donald Trump, but that's not a reason to elect a president. And so I think that's one of the issues. I do think, by the way, that there was bizarre, terrifying intervention from Russia in sophisticated ways we're only beginning to understand, with the tacit encouragement, at the very least, of the Trump administration. Or the Trump campaign, I mean to say. But the main issue is Democrats and have to talk about what we're for. And I hope we do a better job of doing that. None of this is just given to us, this democracy thing. I was listening to this interview of Condoleezza Rice with her new book, and she was, you know, saying she's obviously a deeply accomplished person. I respect that part of it, but she was saying something like, well, you know, this democracy is—it's in our DNA here in America. No, it isn't. This is not something that we have these freedoms. And there was a point right after the election when I thought, frankly, Trump would be more effective. I'm glad, frankly, he hasn't been that effective. Right. But I was thinking, okay, this is what it could feel like to really watch this slip away. And I believe, you know, when you look at the civil liberties issues, when you look at the immigration issues, when you look at the attacks on the media and all of that, no, this is not part of our DNA. And yes, you have to fight for it. And we shouldn't convince people that somehow this will all go away because we magically are Americans and magically we have democracy. I can see a pretty easy slip into totalitarianism in this country. And that scares the hell out of me.
There are a lot of people that I know, that I talk to, that I'm around, who have given up on the party because they feel like the party has given up on them, right? That they voted their entire lives and they went to the meetings and they da-da-da-da-da, and like the world is still the place that it is for them. What do you say to those people?
Well, I should give some context. You know, one of the things that Obama asked me to do was to be vice chair of the Democratic National Committee, and I wound up being the whistleblower on Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who I thought, by the way, when we go through some of the reasons why that campaign was lost, I think she deserves a lot of blame, frankly. But so I'm not a person who gravitates necessarily to a party, and I didn't get my party's endorsement to my third term as mayor. But
with that said,
the history of this period of time in the United States is not about two parties abandoning people. It's about two parties with two different philosophies, and one of them was captured by a group of extremists who took the most extreme ideology possible and hijacked the Republican Party. The Democratic Party had the majorities in the White House and Congress for 2 years. And during that time, we delivered health care to 20 million people, saved the auto industry, did the Recovery Act, which is the greenest act in the history of America, brought human rights into our foreign policy, had the Justice Department become deeply engaged in police misconduct, which is a pretty difficult thing to do, knowing policing is local, but the federal government was involved in it, appointed Supreme Court justices who did have done really remarkable things. And that was in that two-year period before the Congress got taken over because the Republicans successfully exploited the health care issue. So it's sort of like saying, oh, gee, the wind is blowing at me, so I'm going to give up on walking. The fact of the matter is we have a choice, and we're in a dogfight for the values of this country. So I don't ask people to march in lockstep to people. I ask them to be deeply disruptive within systems and outside of systems. But the fact of the matter is people who just said, oh, pox on all their houses, I won't vote in the election, are complicit in the fact that right now Donald Trump is taking actions that means the Latino kid who's in school today is not positive whether dad's going to be home at night.
Are they complicit though? People push and say that why participate in the system that has not worked for them?
Well, I get that. If all of us can lead lives that are comfortable with changes being put in by those who are participating in the governance of the country, there's an authority that we've collectively chosen to be the federal government. We own that. If you choose not to be part of the ownership, that's your prerogative. But the fact of the matter is somebody's going to own that. So if you're really comfortable with everybody else owning that, especially when you see some of the consequences when certain people take control of that, I guess that's your prerogative. But as somebody who shares this planet and this country with you, I really ask you to think pretty damn hard about the consequences. I mean, when you think that the Environmental Protection Agency is being taken over, is being purged of people who believe in climate science. If you live in a condominium and you choose to not participate, you can't complain about, you can, but you do have the possibility to control what the place is like. And if you choose not to, you're leaving it up to all the other people. And there's some people I don't want it left up to right now.
Get that.
Donald Trump starts with it.
Are there any issues that you, so one of the interesting things about being an activist, especially in the wake of the initial protests in Ferguson and Baltimore and so many other cities, I've learned so much about so many topics that I didn't know before, right? So from welfare, which I thought I understood well, and now I know much right. better, like mass incarceration or police contracts, things like that.
Right.
What issues do you think are really important that people that don't make the national headlines?
Well, first off, I have to give you and many, many other people tremendous credit for pushing people on the issue of police and accountability and culture. It was the toughest thing I had to do as mayor, and it's a hugely important issue. And I mean, I think the it's part of this larger issue too. And it even ties to what I was just talking about now. Common ground is incredibly important. What we choose to do together is, I think, why we are civilized people. And if you think about government and police and all of that, it's really that all of this is really pretty simple. It's what we choose to do together that we can't do ourselves. So we've chosen that instead of you and I having guns and bars on all of our houses and, you know, gosh knows what else, we've chosen, or maybe in addition, we say, okay, we're going to hire this person over there to work together for our public welfare, to protect and to serve us. When that person doing that is not reflecting our values, we have to step in. That's common ground. It's the same as a physical common ground that you and I can live in our own place, but we choose to have a park where we can come together. We choose to have sidewalks where it's free for all of us. When that gets into something that we don't like, we engage in it. So I think this issue of the common ground, the common good, the common weal, what are we doing together, is very much in play right now. I mean, I'm leading a foundation now. I love that work because what it is really saying people have the right to do whatever they want with their money. But if they choose, it's a community foundation too. So different, we have 1,300 people with funds there. So the idea is each of them can do whatever they want. But if we go to them with ideas, if we convene them together, if we create a common ground, that makes sense. Not everybody can be putting money into a foundation, but all of us in our own way have the ability to choose to do something larger with our life than our own individual action. And I live in a city where the most beautiful natural urban environment of any city in America, we chose not to have the lakes be privatized or the rivers or the parks, but all of it is common ground. That's almost unique in America. And it's a wonderful thing, but don't take it for granted.
I like that. So there are a lot of people who now want to run for office. Right.
Good.
They have gotten the bug and the itch about being a public servant in a formal way. What advice do you have to those people?
I would say the most important thing to do is to do two things. Look in the mirror and listen. Look in the mirror means when people will say, and they'll ask me, you know, I'm an experienced politician. You've won some elections. What should I do? What should I do? I say, first off, be exactly who you are. And before everybody comes at you with everything else, you know, like when you were running for mayor in Baltimore, your agenda was super authentic. It didn't look like it came through a factory of some political machine about what you're supposed to say. When people say, what am I supposed to say? I'm saying, you're the only one who can answer that. The beautiful thing right now is authenticity is the best political weapon. And Trump is authentic, I guess, but, you know, but it all up and down the political spectrum. The thing that's going away is the freeze-dried politician who seems to be saying what you want. And I just love all the people I see coming out who are running because they're not necessarily doing it for to follow the rules. But the listen thing is hard too because I'm not a natural listener. I was a reporter, however. And it really trained me to when I find somebody to go still enough that you can hear them, really honestly hear them. So when I door knocked the city, because I had no money, I wasn't taking money from people doing business with the city. Nobody gave me a chance. So I just door knocked. And at first I'd, you know, knock, knock and, hey, MRT, Ryback. And I give him a big pitch and it didn't go anywhere. And then I thought, wait a minute, I've done this before. I was a reporter. I walked up the doors. I listened to people and then I told their story. So do it again. And so day after day after day after day, I was just going around the city. I wasn't giving speeches. Nobody was paying attention to me. And I just listened and listened, actively listened. And then the second part that's important is to tell that story. So if you start as authentically as this is me, and then you really, really listen, the wisdom is not, you don't have to know everything. You have to know how to access the collected knowledge of people.
And what, that makes sense. And I think about, it was, you know, it was something. It was some parts of it were fun. Door knocking was amazing.
Yeah.
I think that that is one of the, running for office made me even more committed to the work of nuts and bolts organizing. Right?
Yeah.
Because that's like what it is at its heart. Mm-hmm. What is a piece of advice that you've gotten over your career that has stuck with you?
I would say one that I like is the saying that the world stands aside for those who know where they're going. And when you really apply that to a lot of things, there are vacuums that are created all over the place. You know, something where something should happen and people will say, why doesn't someone or why doesn't this and that? Own the vacuum. Jump into the place where there's a vacuum because I think that's important.
Well, RT, thanks for being on Pod Save the People today.
Well, thanks for doing it. And you are a hugely important voice. So keep talking.
I appreciate it. And hopefully you will be hopefully you'll be back. You're a friend of the pod now.
Okay, that's a good thing to be.
Well, that's it. Thanks for listening to Pod Save the People. Make sure that you rate it wherever you get your podcasts and make sure that you tell a friend to listen too.